What is going on, everybody? Welcome to another draft podcast on the Baseball America feed. I'm Carlos Colazo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. What's going on, Peter?
Not much. I'm excited to dive. I think we've got a fun episode today with a little bit of top 100 talk, some fastball shape. And I'm playing hurt. I'm battling a sinus infection, but I'm still juiced up.
Oof. I don't know that I've ever actually had a sinus infection, but they sound horrible. So hopefully that goes away quickly, Peter.
Yeah, no, I know from if I'm a listener to this, if my voice sounds very annoying, I'm right there with you. So, but nonetheless, I'm excited to dive into what we got going on.
Yeah. So, obviously it was top 100 week or day. I think it's probably top 100 week. It's fair to say, just given the amount of content we're running out. On the website, if you're listening to this on Friday, the top 100 was dropped Wednesday. If you are a Baseball America subscriber or just frequent the website, I'm sure you know about that. It was all over our social media feeds. So fun to finally get that list out there. But I wanted to briefly talk about some of the draft guys on that list. Just because there's a fairly large group, I wasn't sure. We did a top 100 roundtable podcast yesterday on the Baseball America feed. I mean, if you're listening to this, you probably see that show as well. So if that's something you're interested in checking out, I mentioned this, like there are 16 2023 draftees on the top 100. That feels like a little bit more than normal for this time. Just given the draft cycle and given some of the graduations and the relative state of minor league prospects and the comparative strength of the 2023 class. But there are some players who have moved up significantly from pre-draft feedback and now post-draft feedback. I guess the four biggest names in terms of up arrow movers would be Matt Shaw with the Cubs. He is ranked 31 on the top 100 right now. Going down further, we have Hurston Waldrop at 49 with the Braves. Then we have Colt Emerson at 52 with the Mariners. And then the last name I would think of as like an up arrow post-draft name would be Bryce Eldridge at 57 for the Giants. One of the things that I've struggled with, I think, in the past is properly weighting the new information from pro debuts. I think early on in my time at BA, where I was mostly focused on the draft and didn't do a ton of prospect coverage, I probably erred more towards the not reacting enough to initial pro debuts and pro data and pro scouting feedback. And I think I've tried to correct, at least in terms of like what's useful to update your information. But those are the four guys that have really either taken a step forward, or the data we have seen with them has been better than I expected. I'd say with Bryce Eldridge and Colt Emerson specifically, the power numbers have been tremendous. And then with Hurston Waldrop and Matt Shaw, two guys who, I mean, all these guys were first round picks and we had them ranked fairly high, but just the performance they showed in the upper levels of the minors really helps, I guess, add to the conviction of the profile. So are there any 2023 draftees on this list who stand out to you? It doesn't have to be these guys, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, in that same stroke, Hurston Waldrop had, I think, undisputed the best pro debut of any pitcher in this year's class. And Wyatt Langford had the best debut of any hitter. He's very well represented at number five on the list. And then I think with guys like Emerson and Shaw, Emerson in particular, I'm a big Matt Shaw guy. I liked him a lot at Maryland. He's very well represented at 31, but Emerson at 52, I think he's a guy that as these updates keep churning out, I think he's going to keep going up and up and up. I'm a huge believer in the offensive skill set. Defensively, he can more than hold his own at the dirt, regardless of where he ends up, whether it's at second or at short. He looked good at shortstop in a limited sample in Modesto, but Emerson's a guy of those four that you have mentioned that I think we could see even inside the top 35, top 30 or so as we keep going through the cycle. And I'm at the equivalent of where you were when you just started at BA1, because I kind of just did start. I'm 15 months in now, 14 months in, primarily draft and college. But I think that, you know, as I get deeper, I'm excited to see where Emerson ends up. And scrolling down through the board, I'm trying to, anyone that's a top 100 prospect in baseball, you can't really call them too big of a sleeper, but guys that just missed the cut, one that just missed the cut that I think could very much pop on here, in being a solid spot is Tommy Troy. infielder in the Diamondbacks organization, had good a standout career at Stanford. He had a solid pro debut, showed well in High A Hillsboro. Still kind of getting adjusted, but I think that once he gets a full pro season under his belt and gets some more mileage, he's going to, you know, thrust his way onto that list.
Yeah, that's a good call. I think I probably don't view the gap in talent between Matt Shaw and Tommy Troy maybe as big as the list would indicate. And maybe it's just easier to fall in love with what Shaw did in his pro debut, but it was a solid debut for Tommy Troy. I'm a pretty big believer in just his instincts for the game, his all-around feel for the game, the hitting ability. But I do want to circle back to Colt Emerson and Bryce Eldridge specifically, because I think these are two guys who obviously – Bryce Eldridge had some of the best raw power in the class, but just the level of power that he showed against pro pitching with the swing decisions that he paired with that, I thought was really encouraging about his offensive profile. I've spoken about how much I love Bryce Eldridge as a hitter on other podcasts on the Baseball America Network, but it's almost shocking to see where his power is currently as an 18-year-old last summer in a relatively small sample. I mean, most of these samples are pretty small, but his power numbers were up there better than a lot of the college players who are 3 years his senior, much further along in their physical development. And then Colt Emerson specifically, you mentioned your conviction and just his hitting ability. I think the pure hit tool, the offensive approach, the swing decisions, the end zone contact rate, those were all traits that you had to feel really good about him coming out of high school, just given what he did against high school competition. That was there in pro ball. He walked nearly as much as he struck out. The back of the baseball card numbers were good, but the power was significantly better than I expected it to be. It was an average 89 mile per hour exit velocity. The 90th percentile exit velocity was just under 105. And if you compare that to a guy like Jacob Wilson, who I think probably does have better pure bat to ball skills and contact ability, but who's also 3 years older, it's like an 8 mile per hour gap in 90th percentile exit velocity. And prior to the draft, I would have assumed Emerson's raw power and Jacob Wilson's raw power was a lot closer. They were a lot more similar, but just given what Colt did with a wood bat in pro ball at this age was kind of shocking. And I think really explains a lot of why he moved up. I think I had him just inside my personal top 50. He's right outside of the top 50 on the BA list. And I think I agree entirely with you. It wouldn't be surprising at all for him to go out this year and just keep performing. And you really look at a well-rounded, left-handed hitting shortstop who just does a lot of things really well and is like suddenly hitting the ball harder than you expected him to. So he's a really fun one.
Yeah, I completely agree. The hit tool with him is, I think, comfortably plus at this point. And that's a very cold take given both what he did in pro ball and also the Mariners are going to take a guy 22nd overall. If they are convicted on the hit tool. So cold take. And then circling back to an interesting point I thought you made about Matt Shaw and Tommy Troy, and I'm with you that the talent gap isn't far off, but you can't ignore what Matt Shaw did in his pro debut, which was he lit the world on fire in High A South Bend, and then he produced at an almost similar clip across 15 games in AA with the Tennessee Smokies and was a part of their championship winning team. And while I don't think the talent gap is that far off, I think it speaks further to a point you made earlier in the show, which was that, you know, there is something to be said and value to be placed on a strong pro debut like that. So I completely agree with you there. And then another guy kind of sifting through guys who are not on the top 100, who I think have that kind of upside. Kevin McGonigal is another one. He's an infielder in the Detroit Tigers system, was taken 37th overall. I was very bullish on him prior to the draft. He's more of that compact physical frame as opposed to Emerson's lean and wiriness. Granted, I think Emerson only has about 2 or 3 inches in height, but McGonigal is a seriously physical kid. There isn't as much projection remaining, but I'm very bullish on the hit tool. The approach and swing decisions are excellent. He didn't show a ton of power impact in his pro debut, but this kid has outstanding feel for the barrel. He's a gamer. He's a baseball rat. I'm very excited about him and what he's going to be able to do in a full professional season, because I think he's a guy Whether he ends up right on the cusp of the top 100, like 101, 102, 102 when the next update comes out, or even on the top 100 list, I wouldn't be shocked in the slightest. And there are plenty of other guys like that, both on and off the list, who are going to continue to thrust their way up the board. But that was one specific guy that came to mind.
Two guys that I'm really excited about from this 23 class to see in a full season in the minor leagues are two pitchers. And the first one, he's ranked inside the top 10. It's the number one pitcher on the board. It's Paul Skenes, the 1-1 pick. It's not like crazy to be excited about this player, but I do think for whatever reason, because his pro debut wasn't like lighting the world on fire, and the consistent questions about his fastball shape and like comparisons to Yoshinobu Yamamoto, I feel like people are a little lighter on Paul Skenes than I am personally, and I'm really excited to see just what he looks like over a full season. I think he's got tremendous upside. I think he has ace upside. He's the best pitching prospect that I've ever seen at the amateur level. I'm really excited for, I'm kind of calling it jokingly in our BA Slack, the Paul Skenes revenge tour, just to remind people how good he is. Because again, like, just looking back at what he did with LSU, it was unbelievable, the pure stuff he has. I've long been kind of the person who isn't really concerned much at all with his fastball shape. It's a lot of movement, it's precision, it's velocity. I don't think this, it'd be one thing if he didn't get misses on the pitch in college, but he got a ton of misses on the pitch in college with quote unquote substandard fastball shape. I think the slider is a double plus pitch. I think the changeup has a chance to be a plus pitch. And so when you have maybe not the meta fastball shape, but you also have two reliable weapons and plus control to go to, I just think people are nitpicking a little bit too much with him. And maybe I'm also being like overly defensive of him because, again, he is ranked number 9. It is very tough to be ranked inside the top 10 as a pitcher on our list, just given the attrition for pitching prospects in general. So potentially I'm just being a little bit too defensive with Paul Skenes. The other one, and this is more of like a curiosity from my perspective and less conviction, but Chase Dolander, he's number 61 on the board, entered the 2023 draft cycle as the consensus top pitching prospect in the class. Slipped down the board a little bit. The pitch, the fastball quality, the slider quality, the command, they weren't all as sharp as they were in the 2022 season for him at Tennessee. But he still was the third pitcher selected after Skenes and Rhett Lauder, who ranks just above him on this top 100. I'm very curious to see what he's looking like in his first stint in pro ball period. He didn't debut at all in 2023. I think that made sense. Really, most of these college guys that are throwing 100-plus innings, I don't really see the need to activate them given the just the time of the draft at this point. But if Dolander comes out and he's looking more like the 2022 version of himself, this is another player who wouldn't be shocking at all if he just started shooting up boards, because when it's all together for him, it's a plus fastball, it's a plus slider, it's plus control, it's a buttery smooth delivery. He's really athletic on the mound. I love the way he attacks. He's got two additional pitches and a curveball and changeup that, while they might not be as electric or exciting as the fastball slider, I think they could be parts of a really well-rounded four-pitch mix. And so just kind of seeing what he's going to look like, what the pitch shapes are going to look like, what the delivery is going to look like. Is he synced up? How's the fastball command? Like, all of those are questions that I'll be fascinated to see the answers to and just get a better idea moving forward of who Chase Dolander really is. Because if you've seen him at his best, it's really hard to shake just how exciting and electric he is as a right-handed pitcher.
Yeah, I'm with you on both of those guys. And with Skenes, the freak out is stemming from one bad double-A start, his first double-A start, after he threw 122 and two-thirds innings at LSU. So, I mean, he's not exactly like, you know, in primo form here in July or August, whenever that start was made. And the fastball, it's not an eight. Like, it doesn't have that supreme shape like you were mentioning. It's a little bit of a dead zone profile, but he's got plus command and plus control of it. He's regularly bumping 101 and 102 with it, with a little run to the arm side. There's a legit two-seamer there in the tank. And then you're also talking about a double plus slider, a plus changeup, and then with the body of Paul Skenes, he's a 6'6", 235 workhorse who, I mean, it's very easy to envision him being the number one, number two starter for the Pirates in pretty short order. And I think that, you know, again, basing it off one bad outing in Double A is a bit unfair to him. Yeah, there's stuff to work on there with the fastball, and guys in the at that level, the minor leagues, and especially in the big leagues, can put wood on a bullet. But I think this is a classic case of getting too nitpicky. Now, if it kind of rears its head over the course of a full season, then maybe I'll get a little, I'll pay more attention, get a little more iffy on it. But my thinking on Paul Skenes hasn't changed from this time, or I'd say from the time he was drafted to now, really hasn't changed all that much. Then going back to Dolander,
I think before you do Dolander, so do you remember when Paul Skenes would have last pitched for LSU? His pro sample was basically from August 10th to September 1st. He had 5 outings. All of them were just an inning or two. It was 1 inning, 1 strikeout, no hits, no runs his first appearance. It was 1 inning, 1 hit, no walks, 2 strikeouts his next. The next appearance was 2 innings, no hits, no walks, 2 strikeouts. His fourth appearance was his first in Double A, the one you're mentioning, at 0.2 innings. He gave up 3 hits, 4 earned runs, 2 walks, 2 strikeouts. And then he followed up with another appearance in Double A, 2 innings, 1 hit allowed, no runs, no walks, 3 strikeouts. So overall, I mean, it's really a very minuscule sample that we're even evaluating in the slightest. But it is a bit weird that he pitches his full season at LSU, throws 122 and a third or 2/3 innings, gets shut down for some amount of time, and then comes back and throws 6.2 innings in the minors. I thought that was weird at the time, but again, like you, my opinion on Skenes hasn't changed since he's been drafted.
Yeah, that was another weird thing, and I'm curious to see, you know, as we get closer to the professional season starting and into the swing of things here with pitchers and catchers reporting, I'm interested to see if there's anything there. Maybe I feel like we'd know by now in terms of a health concern. But he last threw against Wake Forest. He didn't throw in the College World Series final. He threw 8 innings against Wake. I think it was June 20 something, between probably the 20th and 22nd. That was when he last threw. But going back to Dolander, I think I'm glad you brought him up, because I think he's a prime guy here who's kind of lurking in the weeds, so to speak, who's ready to shoot up boards. Like you mentioned, when he's on and at his best, he's as good as anyone. There's a reason why he was drawing such lofty comps leading into last season. And he was viewed as the kind of the clear number one pitching prospect until probably the second weekend of the season, when Skenes started doing what he was doing. But again, you mentioned plus fastball, plus slider, controls plus, changeup and curveball are both going to flash. You're talking about another guy who's got that front end of the rotation type upside. And I know it's going to be difficult being in Colorado. Not only is Coors a launch pad, but Fresno's a launch pad, and a bunch of their affiliates are. But I think that his stuff's going to play really good against Wood. And I'm with you on someone that could really make a strong first impression.
Absolutely. All right. Well, unless you have another top 100 guy or pro point you want to make, we could probably move on to, again, we talked about Paul Skenes' fastball shape. We can talk about some fastball shapes and fastball qualities of 2024 college pitchers. This week I had a piece, kind of a follow-up to the hitting piece a week before, about exit velocities and chase rates. I kind of wanted to do the same thing but for pitchers and look at fastball shapes, velocities, vertical movement, release points, miss rates, usage, all that kind of stuff, just to try and get a better feel for which were the outlier fastballs in the class, who had questions, who had maybe tweaks you could make to get some improvement from the fastballs this spring, and just overall get like a little bit more granular on the some of the fastballs of the top pitchers in the class. And for this study, I basically just looked at all of our pitchers on the top 100. There are some pitchers who I think either as we expand the list or just later in the year, it would be worth revisiting just to get a bigger sample of pitchers. Guys like Gage Jump or Brandon Neely are two pitchers that weren't featured in this. But I think if we looked at some of their movement characteristics, it'd probably be pretty exciting. But for this one, it was just guys currently ranked in the top 100 outside of one, Pierce George, who just didn't have a huge sample, a big enough sample to really fit in. But I know that prior to the holidays, Peter, we drafted best tools for the college class. I'm trying to remember, who did you take for best fastball? I think I took Michael Massey, but you might have taken him. I don't remember.
You took Massey. Who did I take?
Did you take Brecht for this?
I tried to go, like, I think I took Brecht's slider maybe, and I think I took Nabors' fastball.
Okay, awesome. So I think both of those still hold up after doing this piece as good fastballs. But are there any players who, after looking at this pitch plot, and you can see, like, we've got a plot with average velocity on the x-axis and miss rate on the y-axis, and in addition to, like, full tables with all the data on these pitches if you want to dig in for yourself. But were there any guys that you kind of came away from this and said, you know what, maybe I should have taken this fastball? Or just players who you're like, oh, I didn't realize X about this pitcher's fastball, and I'm either excited or a little more concerned.
Yeah, I think when looking at a graph like this, or any graph in general, the eyes are naturally drawn to any outliers, good or bad. Yeah. And so for this was one, a fascinating piece, and I highly, highly encourage anyone to check it out because it is fantastic. It's an 80, almost like Michael Massey's fastball.
Too optimistic of a grader, Peter. You're giving me too much credit.
No, but it was great. But I think that, you know, in looking at this, I took off Mathis, Benj, and Braden Montgomery just because I think those guys are hitters all the way professionally. They'll be fine in the mound.
I thought about not including them at all, but I kind of just kept them in just to have it.
Yeah, well, like Mathis threw a legit amount on the Cape. He was a starter for College of Charleston. He's definitely fair to leave on. But in terms of guys who I'm a little concerned about, I think Ryan Johnson is one. He's right there just sitting at the bottom of the x-axis, and he gets minimal miss on his heater for the premium velo that he's got. And in looking at the traits of it, it's a true dead zone fastball, which means it gets the same amount of vertical break as it does horizontal break.
Can you dig into that a little bit more? Because dead zone fastball, I feel like, is thrown around a lot. I have a decent understanding of what it means, but if you have a more detailed view of like what that actually means, I think that might be interesting for listeners because I'm sure you could educate me on this too.
Yeah, we can probably tag team it. But basically, again, with Johnson on his fastball last year, it averaged the same amount of vertical break, 11.7 inches, as it did horizontal break, 11.7 inches. And he's got that low release height, but when it's coming to the plate, it's almost just flat on a tee. It's very easy to see, very easy to pick up. It doesn't do a whole lot as it enters the zone.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, when you're looking at the opposite end of the spectrum, which literally here, it's Jansen Kiesel. And when you're looking at Kiesel, last year he averaged over 19 inches of horizontal break, and which means, you know, it has tons of ride and carry through the zone. Mm-hmm. But what also helps it and makes it more of an outlier is his release height of just over 5 feet. And he's 6'4", and he's attacking you from this low three quarters, mid to low three quarter slot with low launch, and it just absolutely explodes out of his hand and goes through the strike zone, and it gets on hitters quick. It's got a ton of life, and I think that, you know, for someone like Johnson, when you're looking at, you know, what can you do to maximize that premium velocity, you've obviously got to refine the pitch shape. And so I think for him, adding in a true two-seamer or a cutter or whatever it is, I'd probably go two-seamer with him because the slider with Johnson is a plus pitch. It's a true sweeper, and you kind of get that in on the hands to a righty with a two-seamer, and then you go away with a sweeper.
Yeah,
I think that would probably maximize his arsenal.
The Johnson and Kiesel kind of dichotomy we're talking about here is very interesting too, because I think – a lot of times usage rate is a pretty good proxy for pitch quality, especially at the amateur level, when really in college too, like if you're using a pitch a lot, it's probably because the college coach knows it's going to be effective. It's the pitch a pitcher is most comfortable with. It's missing a lot of bats. And if you look at the overall usage rate, Ryan Johnson was dead last in fastball usage rate on this chart at 36%. And Kiesel, who you mentioned, he was third most with a 72% usage rate. And I think for the most part, the pitchers who are using their fastballs less frequently, there's a reason for that on this graph. And also, you had mentioned Kiesel, who entering this exercise, I expected him to have some pretty silly numbers because I knew that he had some unique release characteristics and pitch traits. But the degree to which he gets miss in the fastball shape from that angle is so unique. If you look at all of the pitchers who have a release height just in this ballpark, almost all of the players with like a 5.7 foot release height or less have IVB numbers less than 12 inches. So basically they're not getting a lot of riding life on their fastball. And it just kind of shows you how unusual that is. Like typically I think hitters are probably primed to expect the ball to move in a different way from that release point. And this is kind of like the Cooper Jerpy effect as well, I believe. It's just such a unique and odd angle and movement profile for a fastball that, again, is not, I don't know if we've mentioned this, but Keisel averaged 92.4 miles per hour with his fastball. And that's like maybe a tick below the average of this player grouping. So it's not like he's blowing hitters away with velocity. It's not any sort of crazy Brody Breck, Chase Burns speed. It's just such a special combination of release, of pitch movement. And honestly, I think this pitch could improve significantly in 2024, just if he's able to throw more strikes. He was near the bottom in terms of getting this pitch in the zone. I think his walk rates in general have been poor throughout his college career. There are a number of pitchers on this board who probably can get a lot of improvement just by throwing their fastballs over the plate more frequently. But if you look at strike percentage, or maybe even end zone percentage will be a better proxy here. But if you look at end zone percentage, he was fifth worst of this player grouping with just a 40% end zone rate with that fastball. Like the top guys are the Drew Beams, the Trey Savages, the Tyson Nabors who you picked who are near 50% with that. So if he can throw some more strikes this spring, watch out.
Yeah, he's got a chance to really pop. I know right now he's inside our top 100, but with him, consistency is key. If he's able to put together a full productive season in Oklahoma State's rotation, and now it's going to be easier said than done because Obrate is a very hit. The Northwoods League is a true freshman, and the walks were still high, but he was able to get by. And then last year, he was used a little inconsistently at Oklahoma State. He was their midweek starter for a little while. Couldn't really find it. Then he started pitching later in games. He got a spot start later in the year. The ERA inflated, but I think he struck out 34 in 18 innings, but also walked 19 guys. And so going to the Cape, I was really curious. He was a guy that I had kind of had circled going into the summer as someone who I was very excited about to see how the stuff would play against Wood. Mm-hmm. And it was excellent. Again, he was inconsistent. The bad looks kind of bad. You kind of come away from the park thinking he's a reliever type with that fastball slider mix, but his good is, you know, it's as good as anyone that I saw this summer. The fastball was up to 97, 98, again, with that signature riding life from that low release height. Slider is a true sweeper that would also flash plus. And then he developed a changeup, which at this point is a fine third offering for him. It had some late tumbling life to it. But what I was most encouraged about was that improved strike throwing. Now he still had bouts with command, but it's a smaller sample size. But during the spring season, he landed the fastball for strikes at a 57% clip. And then this summer, he landed them at a 65% clip, nice. Which I thought was, if he can keep that up, that's going to go a very long way. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I came away very impressed with him. And I, again, what also helped contribute to the improved command was directionally. I thought he got a lot better from his first start of the summer to his last. He was falling off a lot towards the first base side. Granted, he still falls off a little bit, and there's a little bit of a head whack in the delivery. But he's a lot more on plane towards the plate. So he's a guy that, one, has great present stuff. But two, he's great clay because the makeup is excellent, and he is more than willing to learn and very coachable, which are traits that will serve him very well in professional baseball, especially with his arsenal.
Yeah. Well, moving on to let's talk about Brody Brecht a little bit. I mean, if you had asked me like 10 years ago, if you just look at the information we had available, it'd be pretty easy to say, oh, Brody Brecht is the best fastball in the class. It's 97.7 average velocity last year, which is more than a tick and a half, better than the next best pitcher on the board. But I kind of have like this formatted sheet in Google Sheets with it's kind of color coded in all these categories. And there's really a lot of red, which is like a negative indicator. I have like green as positive and red as negative with this kind of conditional formatting chart that I have. And it's a lot of like red throughout Brody Brecht's fastball. That doesn't mean I think it's like a bad pitch, But I think there are a lot of areas where he could maybe improve. And I think first and foremost is probably just throwing the pitch for strikes. Like Jansen Keisel, he was near the bottom in both strike percentage and end zone percentage with this pitch. I think only Marcus Morgan, his teammate at Iowa, had a lower strike percentage with the fastball than Brody Brecht. If you look at his results against the pitch, just looking at synergy data, hitters don't do damage against the fastball. It's mostly all value that comes from OBP, Brecht hurting himself, just getting in deep into counts, putting batters on base for free. And you also look at the usage of the pitch. It's weird to see 48% usage for a pitch that's basically averaging 98. I think only two pitchers last year in the entire country, regardless of draft class, threw harder than Brody Brecht. It was Paul Skeens and I believe Eric Swan were the only two. So you would really expect, honestly, I would expect him to throw this fastball more frequently. Again, Brecht has maybe the best slider in the country. It's a short list of players that have a slider that can compete for it. It's like Chase Burns, Brecht, maybe some of these like reliever guys like Michael Massey or Tyson Nabors have sliders that you could compare to them. Thatcher Hurd would be one. But I really feel like with the kind of cutting life he gets on the fastball, with the velocity, he gets a ton of ground balls on the pitch as well, which it does seem like more of a ground ball pitch than a missed pitch at this point. But I feel like there is a lot of room for improvement with his fastball, both in terms of shape and just efficiency with the pitch. And I'm curious what you think of his heater, because again, 10 years ago, you probably stick a 70 on this pitch pretty easily and move on with your day. I think you can be a little more critical now, but Brecht is also an immense athlete. And I think he's got a lot of areas where he can improve and kind of develop. And he's far from a polished, finalized product like I think some other players like a Ben Hess or a Drew Beam might be.
Yeah, it's interesting because his profile is so unique for a number of reasons. He just started to focus on baseball full time. Like this fall was his first time ever doing fall baseball at Iowa. He was a former wide receiver on the football team. And it's a premium heater. Velo wise, it's again, he'll sit 97 to 100 with it. He's been up to 101, 102. He got a 104 on a stadium gun. I know that was later debunked. But the Velo's premium, it's got cut and ride through the zone. And the 28% miss rate on the surface, just the miss rate in general on the heater, it's an impressive miss rate on his fastball.
It's above average for just this player grouping, which are the best pitchers in the class too. So that's a good point.
Exactly. But for Brecht, when you have the character, the velocity characteristics that he does, you know, I think that just the snap reaction and snap judgment is why isn't he getting more swings and misses? And I think a lot of it stems from a point you brought up is like the competitive pitch rate and the rate at which he kind of makes competitive pitches. And I know that it's something that it's improved allegedly from the summer into the fall and especially this fall. I think that's what it's going to hinge on. He'll get in.
And even his last few starts in the regular season in 23, he had improved the strike rate. The Iowa, I think as the Iowa data team over there had a nice tweet with some numbers backing that up. So that was encouraging.
Yeah. The strike throwing improved, no doubt. And I think what makes him so dangerous of a pitcher. And I know that there's going to be a narrative about relief risk and him ending up in the bullpen through the draft and even after he's drafted, no matter what he ends up doing.
Yeah.
But I think what makes him so dangerous is that right now he's got above average feel and better feel for that hellacious slurvy slider than he does his fastball right now. And if that fastball feel can improve, kind of like what Keisel flashed over the summer, if he can improve that strike throwing, especially this spring, and being just around the zone and making competitive pitches, I think it's very clear that that miss rate is going to tick up. And I'm not overly concerned about it at all because, again, hitters aren't hitting it right now. Like they're hitting, I think, under 140 against it last spring.
Yeah, I think their slug was under 200 against the pitch as well, if I'm remembering accurately.
Yeah, like it's not a pitch right now. The hitters are barreling. And I think that in looking at all of that under the hood type stuff, it just goes back to him being around the zone, being more competitive, getting in more pitcher friendly counts, not working from behind. I think if he can work ahead, get ahead and stay ahead, it's like a little league. You hear that from like a little league dugout, but it's true. If he can do that more consistently, I'm very confident in that miss rate ticking up.
Yeah, one of the things that I look at now more often than I probably did in the past, just swing rate against. And if you look at the pitchers who are inducing swings with their fastballs, the top of this list are guys like Ben Hess and Drew Beam and Luke Holman and Daniel Avidia, who has the slowest fastball on this list. But it's been extremely effective because of his command, because of the sinking and running actions of that pitch, because of a low release height. But if you look at the bottom of that swing percentage against list, it is guys with strikes concerns. They're either two-way players who you don't think are pitchers, like Carson Bench and Brandon Montgomery, or guys that we're talking about here, Brody Brecht, Jensen Kaiser, Marcus Morgan. All of those guys could do better just by making hitters swing more frequently, because they have plenty of pure stuff to miss bats with. It's just a matter of getting it over the plate. And one thing that I think is interesting with Brecht, and I'm curious what you think about this, but when you watch him pitch, his arm speed is so fast and his arm stroke is fairly compact. I wonder how difficult it is just to time that up, because it is like a lightning quick arm action. It's got to be difficult to time just the release point up there. He's like a pretty easy mover on the mound, but the arm speed is just so quick. I wonder if like that does lead to his elite velocity. I wonder if that also just leads to timing issues with him.
Yeah, it's an interesting point for sure. Like you mentioned, the arm stroke is short and quick. He's as good of an athlete as they come on the mound. Obviously, he was a former receiver on the football team. I think just, again, like you're talking about a guy that it's pretty low-hanging fruit with him to add at least a little bit of polish. And I think that the Iowa coaching staff, especially Coach McGrath, the pitching coach, were very happy to get their hands on him in the fall. And I think really work with him to add that. And I think that, again, there are just little, you know, tweaks you can make to his delivery and stuff like that should go a really long way. So I think that we're going to see, if for as good as he was last spring and for as good of as his flashes were last spring, I think we're going to see an even better Brody Brecht this year for Iowa. It's hard to imagine him not being the favorite for Big Ten Pitcher of the Year. Marcus Morgan, I think, is a chance to be right there with him. So it's going to be a potentially Iowa versus Iowa race for that award.
All right, well, let's move on from Brecht. I don't want to spend the whole podcast on him, but I feel like we could talk about him for hours and it'd still be fascinating and interesting because he is such a fun pitching prospect. But were there any other players that stood out to you that were fascinating from this, or just fastballs that you want to chat about?
Yeah, I think just from a maybe a validation standpoint, excuse me, for being, I'm particularly pretty high on Jonathan Santucci out of Duke. I think, you know, the fact that he averaged or had just over a 30% miss rate with the heater, he's got above average command and control of it. It's been up to 96. It's got that riding life, especially at the top of the zone. And then just looking at Santucci as a whole, as a prospect, got a very easy, repeatable delivery. It's aesthetically pleasing. The slider's also plus. The changeup is also flash plus. So now you're going into the draft with a left-handed starting pitcher. And he's gotten a lot more physical during his time at Duke. I remember spending time around him at Area Code. And this was when he was still hitting and pitching. He had more of that, you know, lean, athletic frame. He was still a strong kid with forearm strength, but he's gotten, you know, plenty physical during his time in college, as we often see with these guys, just as they mature naturally. But you're talking about a durable 6'3 frame left-handed starter with what I think, you know, are three plus pitches we could be talking about. Fastball, maybe you could have as a 55, but two above or an above average and two sixes, that's not going to last very long on the board. And so I think that he's a name to circle as right now a dark horse who could be one of the first college arms off the board. And he was, I kind of liked seeing him and was impressed to see him as a standalone. And then looking more on this chart, I'm trying to think of anyone else who stood up. Danny Avidia stood out to me because he's a guy that we had pegged as that pitchability specialist. Arguably has the best control and command in the draft, along with Wake Forest, Josh Hartle. And the miss that he was able to generate with his fastball was also very impressive. And a lot of that comes to his trademark low three quarter borderline sidearm slot. It's a release height that's sub 5 feet, and he is, I believe, 6'4". It's kind of that long, slingy arm action. Fastball, again, if anyone that is looking at this graph as you're listening along, it'll sit in the 89 and 92 range. But again, though, it has that run and sink out of the hand, and it especially plays well when elevated into the arm side. It's just that change in look for a hitter. It's coming from, you know, not down below, but from, again, a very low release point and exploding out of his hand and going up and out. And it's a very uncomfortable look for both right and left-handed hitters. So it allows it to play up. So he was another impressive one to me. He was in time out at VD with the draft. I think that right now he's an interesting one to me. I'm not sure if he ends up going on day one. It wouldn't shock me at all if he wins WAC Pitcher of the Year again, but I think that he is a mid to third, fifth round type that you can feel really happy getting in that range. He's a back end of the
range. There's a lot to like about him, but I think what's really going to hurt him is that he's a right-handed pitcher and not a left-handed pitcher. And I think the lack of velocity is really going to hurt him more than it might hurt a player like Josh Hartle, who also is towards the bottom of this velocity scale. You just don't see pitchers that are not averaging 90 taken on day one very often at this point, just given the amount of stuff you can choose from. I mean, there will be some teams that buy into his command like you're talking about and think, okay, we have this foundation of great command we can work with. It's a low release point. He does a lot of things well. We can add some velocity. There will definitely be some teams that think that. I think he could really help himself out if he does get a few more ticks of velocity. If he's sitting 92 instead of like 89, I think that makes it a lot easier to convince yourself that the heater is still going to be effective in pro ball. But he is one that I would say, like, this chart, while he does a lot of things really well, like projecting that forward to pro ball, I would be a little more concerned, I think, than I was prior to this chart with him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And with Avidia, again, like this summer, the slider looked, it was, again, inconsistent in its shape, but it looked really good. The changeup plays nicely off the fastball. I don't think it's a plus changeup, but it certainly is it's a 55 type pitch. His pitchability and comfort on the mound is what stands out. And again, as you said, you're not drafting 89 to 92 unless you've got this kind of next level command, and that's what Avidia's got. And again, I don't know if a team might go for that on day one, but third to fifth round, middle of the third round to fifth round, I think that's a prime spot for him to be taken.
Definitely. And one other player I wanted to talk about a little bit there, I do want to get into Ben Hess, because I feel like his fastball, like, across the board has really great characteristics. Maybe it doesn't like jump out in any one particular area outside of, I guess, horizontal break for a right-handed pitcher. He was the most in that category. But Josh Hartle, to me, is fascinating. He's a pitcher who's not really throwing his fastball at a super high usage rate. He mixes in a lot of pitches. He's throwing a cutter, a breaking ball, a changeup. And so I wonder just how this fastball is going to play at the next level, how the lack of power with that pitch is going to maybe scare some teams away, even though he's probably like the most big league ready pitcher of this group. Maybe you could say like a guy like Drew Beam is that pitcher. But if you look at, I expected him to be near the top of this list in both strike rate and end zone rate with the fastball. And it's weird looking at those two numbers for him, because Hartle is above average in strike percentage with a 66% strike rate with the fastball. But if you look at his end zone percentage, it's 42.6%, which is near like the bottom 10 or so. And I wonder how often it's just like, I would love to get edge of the zone percentage numbers, because I imagine Hartle is near the top of that as a guy who has great command, doesn't have an overpowering fastball. And so he is able to find success by pitching just on the edges of the zone and is maybe not filling it up like a Drew Beam or a Savage or a Santucci or a Neighbors. Like, those guys are all filling it up, have riding life on their fastball, get solid miss rates. Hartle is much more of the miss rate is solid with the pitch, which maybe is encouraging with that velocity, but he's much more of like a ground ball fastball pitcher who is getting ahead in counts, working quickly, mixing in a lot of other stuff. So I'm just kind of intrigued how that pitch mix will evolve in pro ball. What sort of power does he add? And which teams, like, I know there are just some teams that just don't want to take fastballs that aren't riding up in the zone. And if you're one of those teams, I'm curious where you would have Hartle on a board, but he's fascinating.
No, it's interesting for sure. And that kind of edge of the zone percentage is, I'd be curious in that if you're able to calculate it, because I guess to some extent it's kind of subjective, but
yeah.
Watching him pitch, there weren't many non-competitive pitches that he made both during the year and then also with USA. Like, he's consistently around the zone with everything that he throws. He throws five pitches. And I think that what's most impressive with him, and he doesn't have that premium fastball velocity, but the sequencing is really advanced. And for guys that are these command and control specialists like Avedia and Hartle, that's what you talk about. You don't necessarily talk about the pure stuff as much, but Hartle does have, you know, the stuff there is legit. It might not be that crazy loud fastball that, you know, his rotation mate Michael Massey has. No one has a Michael Massey fastball. but again, it doesn't have that signature ride in life or signature run. It doesn't have a ton of outlier traits. But the way he's able to sequence the pitches on the mound, he'll pitch backwards, he'll pitch with any of his five offerings.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what helps with it, and he's got the ability to dot it up. And I think also, you know, the curveball, it's got, you know, sharp break and big depth, and now we're kind of getting deeper into Hartle. But the stuff with Hartle is legit, and I think better than what people give him credit for. And at the next level, you're talking about, again, a 6-5 starter, left-handed,
mm-hmm.
big time track record in college and then also on the summer circuit. And I think that with these stuff models, the teams that use these stuff models for heaters, while he might not be kind of at the top of their boards, I think that he's someone that we're going to talk about being the first college arm off the board.
Yep.
Potentially, at least he certainly has that potential, but he's a top 25 or so overall yep. pick for me.
I think Hartle is fascinating because for a lot of teams who either can't afford to miss on a pitcher or don't think that their pitching development is really where it needs to be, Hartle seems like a phenomenal pick because there's really not a ton you need to do to get him to that back of the rotation level. And then for other teams who are either more inclined to take on some risk or who really think that they have pitching development dialed in at the next level, they're like, there's really not much more we can unlock here. Why don't we take a chance on someone like a Brody Brecht or like a Chase Burns, who there's a lot of stuff we can work with and we can refine them a bit. So just the different pitching philosophies and profiles that the teams either will be more drawn towards or run away from is fascinating. But I also wanted really quickly, and I know we're going on at length here, but Ben Hess, his fastball across the board was pretty good. I mean, if you look at it on the chart, he's kind of in this little area of the graph by himself. Doesn't have quite the miss that guys like Jansen Keisel and Michael Massey and Fran Oshel do, who've cleared like this elite 40% miss rate threshold. But outside of them, no one gets more miss than Ben Hess. He throws it for strikes at a really strong rate. Like I said previously, it's got a ton of horizontal break. It's almost 14 inches of arm side running life. He induces a lot of swings. Really outside of like, he doesn't get a ton of ground balls. And I think for the amount of miss that you're getting and for how effectively he uses this pitch, which is sitting at 95 miles per hour, it's just a lot to like. I think Hess and Drew Beam both have really effective fastballs where they do a lot of things well with them. They use it to establish the zone, change eye levels, go to both sides of the plate. These are really like dialed in, efficient fastballs. And maybe it's not surprising that guys like Hess and Drew Beam, who I think probably has an unmatched resume as a starting pitcher in the college level, it's not surprising that his fastball is really helping set up his entire arsenal.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Hess because I think that he's a guy right now, at least in this cycle, he gets one loss in the shuffle of all of these other arms, and then he's a little bit slept on. An injury cut his season short last year, but he was well on his way to another Team USA. He wasn't a USA guy as a freshman, but he was on his way to a USA invite and an all-SEC selection. Got a huge workhorse frame, moves well for his size. His fastball, again, as you mentioned, Lowe's 94, 97, but he's been up to 98, 99. It's got run and ride through the zone, and it's a low release height. He's 6'5". The release height is around 5'8 for Hess, which helps it play up, and it just explodes out of his hands and gets on hitters quick. I think it's a 60. It's hard to say that that's not a plus fastball, both, you know, when you look at him throw, or when you look at him pitch, and you just watch how it acts and watch how effective it is, very difficult to say it's not. And then he's also got an effective slider, kind of gyro in shape, which we talk about dead zone fastball having the same amount of vertical break and horizontal break. You, in that same breath, you, a gyro slider is one that's very similar in vertical and horizontal break. But again, it's effective. It'll flash depth. And then I also really like his changeup. He'll throw up to both right and left-handed hitters. It's got a ton of fade to the arm side. It's another, you know, borderline plus pitch. And I think he's, again, a starter at the next level. He attacks the strike zone, throws quality strikes at that. He's got this very imposing mound presence thanks to his 6'5", 250 frame. And when you're talking about day one guys and these early to middle second round types, I think he fits perfectly. And I think if you know, if you're a team drafting, you get however you go in your first pick and you're sitting there in your second pick in the middle of the second round, late in the second round, wherever it is, maybe even earlier than that, very well could be. And you've got Ben Hess on the board. I think he's a guy that you're going to want to grab.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would be really curious to see what our perceptions of Ben Hess would be right now if he had thrown more than 70 total innings in college at this point, because he does a lot of things really well. So yeah, I think those are the only names that I had in mind to talk about on today's episode. Again, I would definitely encourage you guys to check out this piece in full. You can see all the data. You can kind of copy it and manipulate it and look through things however you want. But the chart's there, the data's there, as well as some write-ups of some of the other players who were kind of fascinating to me on this board. But Peter, anything you want to mention or plug before we get out of here?
Yeah, grinding away on the college preview stuff. That'll be going to the website and also magazine in the coming weeks. Teddy and I, we nailed down our first top 25 of the year yesterday.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah. So we're excited about that. And then, working on those capsules as we speak for the magazine and also the website. Conference previews, will be to follow. And so there's going to be a lot of college content coming out and coming your way in the next couple of weeks.
Very cool. All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. As soon as we get off this podcast, I'm going to be asking you for that top 25 so I can scan down it. That'll be fun. Unfortunately, you listeners will have to wait a little bit longer. But no, thank you guys for hanging out with us. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Thanks for supporting Baseball America in general. We really appreciate it. You guys allow us to do what we do, and we'll try and bring you the best content we can. So for Peter, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.